So, Sadie and I forgot to put a trigger warning in for this episode, and I just wanted to put one in since it covers something we haven't covered before. And this episode contains subjects of child abuse and neglect and all the terrible things like that. So, just a heads up for the episode. It is Sadie's part, which is the first part. So, if you want to skip that, it just goes to a nice little ghost story. Thanks, guys. Enjoy. We are recording.
So, we get weird calls from people at my work.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, the name of the place where I work sounds like it's, like, a research institution, essentially. So they call with their archaeology questions. And, you know, sometimes it's debatable on whether or not the issue is archaeology related, but they don't know who else to call, so they call us. And usually I tell them just to, like, find your local university. We're a business. You'd have to pay us if we did a service like that for you, you know?
Yeah.
And normally it's like, you know, we have a I found a bunch of stones that look like arrowheads down in my creek. A lot of people like that.
Yeah.
And, but, like, the other day, there was a call. It was, like, 4 minutes after closing time, so I really, really didn't want to answer it, but it was ringing, and I can't not answer it if I'm standing there, so I answered it, and this person is like, I'm gonna sound crazy, but I have in my hand right now what appears to be, hey, I think he said 3 inch, but it could be 3 foot. Either way, 3-something of a smaller unit of measurement, inch tall, mummified human. It was like my normal response because I was so taken aback that I didn't even think, maybe I should have this man email me pictures of this interesting thing.
Or call the police.
Or like, I don't think he mummified the thing.
No, but somebody else could have.
What we assume it is like somebody's like stillborn fetus that like wound up in a weird location or something like that. Because it seems like if it's 3 inches, it's too small to be like a viable baby, right? Or just, like a miscarriage they didn't even necessarily realize was happening.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. Either way, I made a big mistake on not having him email pictures of this to us, and that's something I'll think about for the rest of my life. Shall we tell our stories?
Yeah.
Is your story good?
It's pretty good.
Is your story happy?
Yeah, there's nothing sad about it.
Okay, we'll tell my story first.
Okay.
Don't want to end on a sad note if we don't have to.
All right, let's go.
So, my story is about Sean Paddock. Maybe Paddock?
That's that name sounds say. Familiar.
Sean Paddock. Source, Pound Puppy Legacy, which is an archive of newspaper articles for, like, relating to, like, I don't know if it's homeschooling or adoption. I don't remember which one it was. But just, like, whole archive of newspaper articles. HS, Invisible Children. HS stands for homeschool.
All right.
Gems, gems.com and wral.com. So, Sean Paddock was the adoptive son of Lynn and Johnny Paddock of Johnston County, North Carolina. He and his older brother and sister were, the last three adopted by them, and they had 7 children in total. I think 1 or 2 were biological, the rest were adopted. And this story's just, like, all sorts of weird on so many levels. Like, bad on so many levels. Like, so
well, when you start out with it being an adopted kid with multiple adopted children, that's when it's already red flags to me.
So, according to Johnston County Social Services records, red flags had been reported about the conditions of the Paddock household 7 months before Sean and his siblings were officially adopted by them, because they did, like, a home visit.
So why would they be allowed to adopt still?
There's lots of questions. We'll get to them. So, because they do, like, a brief home visit, stay a weekend or something like that, you know, to see if everybody vibes together or something, I guess. And then Sean and his siblings return to their foster home, and the foster home, like, the foster family is the one who contacts social services saying, like, he has significant bruising on his back. Like, what happened to him. This is weird.
How old was he?
Three.
Oh, I was gonna say, I guess I couldn't really say he could, but no one's gonna believe what the 3-year-old says.
Itty bitty dude. And the paddocks say it's because he fell off of the bunk bed. But the foster mother was like, I really don't think it is.
What kid falls off of a bunk bed just fully on their back?
Here's the thing.
When kids are falling, they always end up, like, falling on their stomach, I feel like. Especially from, like, a height like that. They're kind of like cats. Time for
him to flip a little bit, right? No, but my thought is...
Unless someone's picking him up and throwing him down.
Maybe I'm overprotective in some way, but I feel like a 3-year-old is a little young to be on the top bunk. Without supervision.
Yeah, no, they shouldn't be up there. To the point that
they're, you know, falling and severely bruising their back.
Yeah.
Like, that's just...
And that should have been reported.
Yeah. It's in the records.
Well, I'm saying by the people when it happened. Yes, he should have gone to a doctor or something to get checked out after it happened, if that's what happened.
Immediately called up the foster family. Yeah. Like, he just fell out of the bunk bed. He has a big old bruise. Like, he's fine. But just so you know, like, immediately be, you know, forthright. So, the foster mother's suspicious. They ask, hold on. Oh, this older siblings are asked about what happened to Sean. How'd he get the bruise? And they talk about their time there, saying that Lynn, the mom, had denied Sean lunch when he wouldn't jump on the mini trampoline the family had. Not that he wouldn't stop jumping on the mini trampoline.
That he wouldn't.
Which either way, it's still not a reason to deny a child who's especially that young food or any.
Yeah.
He shouldn't be denying food as a punishment. But the fact that he wasn't going to do it is so weird to me.
Yeah.
That's so upsetting. That should have been a nope, you may not have any more. We're probably just going to take the ones you have.
We're taking all the kids, yeah.
Like, that's a not okay thing to do. Like, if these families are going to be checked that much, you might as well actually do your freaking job.
Yeah.
So these children, meaning the three, I don't know their biological last name.
We get who you're talking about.
Anyway, Sean and his two older siblings, they had a rough life. They had been taken away from their biological family because the father had abused the sister and the mother refused to leave him.
Great.
The three had gone to live with the aunt and uncle for a time, but they had three kids of their own and three bonus mouths to feed it's all hard. Of a sudden yeah. was to, they couldn't financially handle it. So they went to the foster care system temporarily because the aunt and uncle planned on getting things figured out, ironed out, so that they could take the kids back.
Yeah.
That was 100% their goal the entire time, was to get these children back, which means they should not have been available for adoption.
Yeah, no.
And this is, like, fully on record. This isn't just, like, the family talking. This is what it was supposed to happen. But I think they, like, there was some weird county switch at some point, and then counties didn't communicate right, and then that's what happened. That's how I understand that this happened, is that one county was very incompetent and not the original county these kids were in.
Yeah.
So a month after Sean comes back with a big bruise on his back, the paddock house is finally investigated, which is not okay that it took that long, because that means they have so much time to get everything in order and get all the stories straight. They show up. They find a clean house. They find it has enough beds for all of these new children they're going to take in. You know, the pantries are full. Like, everything is... When I read it, I thought, that sounds too good. Like, it sounds like they're trying too hard.
Yeah, if you already have multiple kids in the house, it shouldn't look like that.
Not to say that you can't have, like, a tidy house with kids, but also, like, I don't assume you're going to have a tidy house with that many kids. There's always going to be a little thing that shows, right? Okay. So sometime mid-2005, the children are adopted by the paddock. So this is like 7 months after the initial home visit. This is the summer of 2005. Sometime in early 2006, and I mean like early, February, March, something like that. Paramedics are like listening to their little radio and hear that a 4-year-old boy is, oh, this is like gone into cardiac arrest. The mother is trying CPR. And they're like, okay, we will respond to that. I didn't realize that's how ambulances worked.
Yeah.
Until I read this. It's like, oh, you just choose your cases. So paramedics arrive at the paddock house. They meet Johnny in the yard where he said, hurry, my son's in the kitchen. In the house, they find a volunteer rescue worker who had arrived first, trying to puff air through the boy's clenched teeth. He, like, anyone can listen to these scanners. So yeah. He's one of those people who trying to get there sooner. Because I think they were, like, mildly remote where they are.
Yeah. So
it truly could have made a difference if there had been anything to save. If the volunteer rescue worker had made it there on time. But it's been too late for Sean. He is stiff as a board. They find him. He's dressed in a t-shirt and soiled underwear. He has no pulse found. His skin is blue. They take him to the hospital. This is normal with kids to take, even if they've already obviously passed, take him to the hospital and have the doctor pronounce him dead. Because it just...
They can be brought back easier than adults, I think.
When they, it's always a weird chance that you can bring him back. You also don't want to be wrong, and then there was a chance to save it, and you find out later, especially with kids, because people are a lot more sensitive about that, and you're more likely to press charges. Just for liability reasons, you get that doctor to say they're dead. So an autopsy was conducted on Sean's body. I'm not sure if it's the autopsy that led to the arrest that happens later, or if it's the testimony of Sean's older siblings. Either way, Lynn Paddock is arrested shortly after Sean's death and is charged with first-degree murder. I think both Paddocks are charged with child abuse, but I don't think
They should.
The charges go through for Johnny. I think they only go through for Lynn. Johnny joking. Somehow gets out of this without anything at all.
That's wrong.
And I'm about to detail a lot of stuff.
All right.
So, Jean had died from suffocation. Lynn had bound him so snugly in a blanket that he lost consciousness and suffocated.
How do you even do that?
He was literally unable to move his chest enough to breathe properly.
Yeah, how do you do that to a four-year-old by yourself is what I want to know.
I don't know how you do that to a four-year-old, even with other people. I don't know how you bind something that tight.
No.
With a blanket, specifically a blanket. I know how you could do it with, like, other things. Blankets are, like, big and unwieldy. You can't get everything quite tight. I can't even get a towel to stay around my waist after a shower. Like,
I don't know.
I literally don't know how you deal with garments that big, getting them that tight. So this was a regular form of punishment for Sean, of being bound tightly in a blanket.
Uh-huh.
The binding that had resulted in his death, what had happened at least, had happened multiple times already that week alone. Like, that was not even the first time that week he'd been bound this way. And it was because he was getting up and playing at night. Not even necessarily loudly, literally just, like, getting up.
Yeah.
And he would just be bound in bed, even just to get a drink of water or to go to the bathroom. So they go in to investigate, and the Johnston County Sheriff, Steve Bizzell, quoted that what they found out about what happened to Sean is one of the most extreme cases of torture of a child that he had ever seen. And there's no excuse or explanation for how he was treated.
Great.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, when I see those things, it's like, okay, it's the sheriff for just this county. Maybe he's been lucky and just not seen extreme cases. But this is an extreme case, even if that is. Even if that is the case. So along with the binding, Sean was punished with fasting. So, you know, more meals were taken away, which we already knew pre-adoption. This is a punishment that they used. That Sean and his siblings were beat with plastic plumbing pipes. That's what everything kept saying, plastic plumbing pipes. I think they just mean PVC. Yeah. But maybe they mean those weird flexible ones, like you have in your house.
Well, hitting with a rubber hose isn't supposed to leave bruises, so maybe that's what they were trying to use, some kind of big rubber hose
blue plastic plumbing pipes. Anyway, Sean was beat so severely that afterwards he was limping and was just literally covered head to toe in bruises.
Jeez.
During the autopsy, the examiner found bruises covering Sean's back and buttock from the pipe.
Did no one ever come check on these kids?
Right? Like, after things like this, you would think, like, they'd need a semi-regular surprise, just, like, physical exam for, like, adopted kids. That seems very invasive, but if you need them for sports, you can disguise them like that, you know?
Yeah.
So, during the trial, the defense attorney argued that Sean's death was accidental and the result of discipline, not abuse. But yeah,
are they one of those weird Christians that believe that?
Here's the thing. I think if your discipline results in death, that's just torture.
Yeah.
That's not discipline.
It's called abuse, actually.
Like, that's not acceptable. So now we get to what Lynn said in court, or I assume in court. Lynn says this at some point, that she had swaddled Sean to stop him from getting up from bed to play. And was shocked that after she last checked him, which had been at 3:30 a.m.,
Why were you up at 3:30
a.m.? He's a 4-year-old. I don't think they need that.
They do not.
Yeah. It's like, maybe I don't understand parenting as much as
I thought. No, they're supposed to go to bed, and unless they're, like, calling you.
Yeah, you wouldn't get up at that time. Maybe he was calling her. He's clearly very wrapped in this blanket and it can't be comfortable, and he soils himself at some point in the night. Maybe it was that she's responding to. I don't know. Either way, it also could be that's when she swaddled him. She, like, heard him doing something, being up for some reason, and decided that was a nope and wrapped him up in the blanket. Either way, so sometime between 3:30 and 7, when she goes in to check on him again, he is dead. When she walks in and finds him, he is stiff as a board. Like, he's been dead. Mm-hmm. She also says that she tried CPR, but he was unresponsive. But she did, for some reason, think she was still alive. I think that was just denial or trying to seem less...
Knowing she's going to get in trouble.
Guilty.
So she's trying to bring him back?
Yeah. Something like that. But people aren't usually stiff and alive, especially kids. Then Lynn talks about her own abuse from when she was a child, that her mother drank and took pills, that the primary form of punishment she was growing up was being beaten with a big, very heavy, but flexible PVC pipe.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, she goes into foster care herself. As an adult, she was unable to conceive, so her and her husband turned to adoption. They opt for older children after prompting from a local, like, pastor, I think. They're like, yeah, that's the way to go. So they start adopting older kids. A few of their other adopted children had anger issues and some mental health problems. So rather than, you know, getting them the help they need, or, you know, the therapy and counseling and, you know, other devices to help deal with these problems, they look for some stronger methods of discipline. Because that's what you need to do for people with mental health issues. Physically beat them. They specifically turn to the discipline techniques that are outlined by Reverend Michael Pearl. Have you ever heard of the Pearls?
No.
Michael and Debbie Pearl. They're known for books like To Train Up a Child, which includes, like, blanket training, which is, like, you put the baby on a blanket, and then you try to, like, you're like, oh, come on, come on, come off the blanket. Don't come off the blanket. And you, like, you smack them with, like, a ruler or something.
Why just are to, like, people like this?
That's break them from trying out new things on their own, essentially.
Why don't we break adults of doing things?
That's like, so Lynn said, quote, "We liked Michael Pearl's," and this is in parentheses, "system because it was quick," in parentheses, "and it didn't demean the child or bring their self-esteem down." I don't know what that means. I think, like, all of these things are demeaning and bring down self-esteem. But what they specifically mean by that is that in the Pearl system, it is recommended that you use things like a flexible rubber hose to beat the child, so or a switch to beat the child, because something about smacking with the hand would demean the child and lower their self-esteem, but smacking them with, apparently, if you slapped them with, like, a wooden spoon, I feel like, apparently, like, that wouldn't work in their system. Or, I mean, sorry, would be okay in their system, but punching them wouldn't. All of this is just terrible. Don't do these things.
I don't understand.
I don't understand how any of this is reasonable to anybody. But this is genuine. They turn to this system because they have children with anger issues and mental health problems. That's, like, the biggest of the red flags.
No, they should not be adopting people. You're literally just an abuser, you psychopath.
Oh, absolutely. So, after much investigation about the patterns of abuse that were happening in the house, expert witnesses, like, in trial declared that, like, not only is abuse happening, this abuse is ritualistic in form. Like, it's not just... Which is worse than just general beating.
Yeah.
I don't know how. I don't know how to explain that, but I do know.
Well, if you're doing all of these things on a scheduled clock, basically, that's worse than just, like, snapping and doing it occasionally, which neither is good, but the other one's satanic, I feel like, almost in a way.
No, that's exactly what it is.
Like, all right, Aubrey, 10 o'clock, oh, time to get out of the yard so I can beat you. Can you imagine?
She's so asleep. Okay, so what I'm about to read next is directly out of the WRAL article. So Lynn Paddock denied claims by some of the children that she wrapped their faces in duct tape or forced Sean and his sister to eat feces. She said she did make Sean's brother eat his own vomit, but she said...
Why?
But she said... She thought he was acting like two of the other children who had forced themselves to vomit in some form. Like, I don't know why they were doing it. Probably because they're living in a very bad environment. It was some form of control. Or stress. Either way. So she's saying, no, she didn't duct tape anybody's face, and she did not make Sean and his sister eat feces, but she did make his brother eat vomit.
Like, that makes it better.
She apparently thinks it's just, that's fine. Because she thought he was doing it to act out. Therefore, it's absolutely logical, right? That you make a child eat their vomit, rather than addressing the situation as to why they're acting out. So I don't know where they get this from, but they said Sean had anxiety from having his mouth taped shut and from being forced to lie underneath furniture. And I don't know if this is something that siblings are reporting or what. I hope it's the siblings. I hope people didn't know about that on the outside and just let it go.
And didn't do anything?
Yeah, it's like, I wish they had somebody to tell, but I don't want anybody on the outside to have known and not done anything either. That's
somehow worse. Because then they should be in jail.
Yeah, exactly. Sean's older siblings had pressure sores from being confined to their beds. I assume that means, like, tied down.
Yeah.
Or being wrapped up in a blanket, too, maybe. Either way. They were forced to drink excessive amounts of water and wear diapers because they were drinking so much water they couldn't control their bladders anymore. And they were also denied food at times. All of the children showed signs of being victims of starvation under the Paddock's care. And all of the children who were sent to foster care after Sean's death gained significant weight, like, so that they were actually healthy weights.
Yeah.
Normal. As soon as they were out of the home. So, like, every single one of them was undergoing all of these forms of abuse, even though during interviews, the kids that are not biologically related to Sean all, like, not a single one of them were ever like, yeah, definitely this is happening. They were so
scared,
programmed and scared that they didn't. However, this is something that happened to one of the other children. One child reported that she had been beaten, put in isolation, and entombed in pillows and blankets with a bookshelf placed over the top of her as punishment once. It's like, obviously this is happening to everybody.
Yeah, it's not just him, yeah.
So Lynn was sentenced to life in prison for Sean's murder and was also found guilty of child abuse. Her lawyer tried to get the child abuse charges removed because it added 77 years to her life sentence, but it was already a life sentence.
So what does it matter?
Well, he said that was just defamation overkill. Or something. And I was like, no, that's not overkill. She should be charged with all the things she did.
Yeah.
End of story. Because it's not changing her sentencing.
No.
And yeah, Johnny Paddock was never charged because there's no solid evidence about his involvement in the abuse. He very specifically was not allowed to be a disciplinary in the house because Lynn said he overdid it. So she took it over.
So how was he not charged with anything if she says he was worse than her?
It's just all hearsay, I guess. I don't think they have, like... He wasn't
if there's abuse going on in your household, you should both be charged. No, you should both be charged.
Yeah.
Especially if it goes that far. I mean, they should all be charged anyway.
If he's not guilty, he should have left. He should have been reporting. He should be getting those kids out of there. He should have been keeping those kids safe. Like, he's absolutely part of the problem.
Well, and she said they both liked that one pastor guy. Mm-hmm.
They chose together to use the Pearls methods of punishment.
You know, it's North Carolina, and I'm not going to call everybody there stupid, but I'll call most of them stupid.
Oh my gosh.
Well, why isn't he in jail?
Gosh, but like...
Where is your logic?
It doesn't make sense to me. It's just so frustrating. One, like, these kids were abused. Two, this kid died from the abuse. But this kid
And still
never...
no one seems to care. Nothing happened out of it, basically.
That's true. So little happened out of it. They were never supposed to be up for adoption in the first place. It was never supposed to be an opportunity to have this happen under these people's control. Like, the biological family wanted them back.
Stupid, Sadie. That's what I said. And so, I stand by it.
I know that, like, shortly after this happened, the biological family was taking legal action against the, I don't know if it was the state or the county...
Whoever messed it up
for this happening, for That's them good. Not, and like I, multiple people in the family, not just like the aunt and uncle.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if all of them were doing it for the right reasons, but either way, the state needs to be punished for it. So.
Yeah, because they're kind of the reason why that kid died.
They absolutely are. Because they weren't checking up enough, because they were not listening to the red flags that were already there.
Because they shouldn't have been adopted anyway.
Because they should not have been available for adoption. It's just frustrating. Anyway, there's more in this that are related to this Pearl method of, like, child rearing punishment. I don't know what it's considered.
Just call it child endangerment.
Because
that's what it is.
Pearl form of child endangerment. That'll, like, cover eventually, but this one is the one I knew the least about. It's the least talked about one.
I feel like the name is familiar.
It's probably, but I don't know why. Usually attached to the other two individuals. This is, like, a definite thing that's happened to. There's two other adopted children. I think they're both adopted from foreign locations, and that's why they got more coverage.
Yeah.
It's because they're international adoptions that were murdered, and this is just an unlucky American foster child.
Yeah.
Which all of them are. So upsetting. That should be just as talked about as those other two.
It's like that Tennessee lady.
Mm-hmm. You really don't hear about her either.
No.
I never remember
her. It's
name
always
either.
Like abusive women that you never hear about.
Yeah. It is. You're absolutely
Which
right.
doesn't make sense.
I think it's something about the patriarchy.
What does that have to do with anything?
Like, women are threats. You can't know that. We can't know that the women can have control.
I mean, that's good that we don't teach people that so we can get away with killing men who deserve it, but...
But at the same time... I think it's related to that. It's changing, like, status quo and narratives in a way that people don't want to, even if... You would think that proving that women can't do anything would be better, but not that that's proven
like,
at all.
Like, they
but...
can't even take care of this kid right.
Yeah, exactly. You think that would be, like, a beneficial thing to the narrative, but...
But then who would cook for them?
Exactly. Then who would cook for them?
Who would cook? Who
There's
would stay home?
Too many
home?
Things they'd like to maintain the status quo to speak about that.
So my story today is about Cape Hatteras Lighthouse.
A lighthouse?
Hatteras?
We haven't had one of those in a while.
So I got my information from visitnorthcarolina.com, nps.gov, hauntedplaces.org, and hatterasrealty.com. So first, history is kind of long. Let's get set up. So, construction of a lighthouse at Cape Hatteras was first authorized in 1794 when Congress recognized the danger posed to Atlantic shipping running into the shores and rocks and whatever.
Yeah.
However, construction did not begin until 1799, so those ships were lost. I'm assuming. So the first lighthouse was lit in October of 1803.
1803?
1083. What do you think it should be?
Oh, that makes more sense. Yeah. I was like, what?
1803. It was made of sandstone, 90 feet tall, and the lamp was powered by whale oil. Happy Earth Day. The 1803 lighthouse was unable to effectively warn ships of dangerous diamond... of the dangerous diamond shoals because it was too short. The unpainted sandstone blended in with the background and the signal was not strong enough to reach mariners.
So just all around in a real
and
bad job.
Also the tower was poorly constructed and maintained, and frequent complaints were made regarding the lighthouse. So it was useless. In 1853, following studies made by the Lighthouse Board, it was decided to add 60 feet to the height of the lighthouse, making it 150 feet tall.
Hold on. 1853?
Yes.
So 50 years.
From literally when they decided they needed a lighthouse, 1794 to 1853.
They did not have a properly functioning lighthouse until then. That's so funny.
Well, even then, hold on.
Oh, wait. It's still not
1853.
Good.
That's just when they decided that this is what happened. So the new Lakes and Tower was then painted red on top of white, making the lighthouse more recognizable during the day. During this time, the tower was also retrofitted for a first order Fresnel lens, which used refraction as well as reflection to channel the light, resulting in a stronger beam. So by the 1860s, I don't even know when they actually made it this. I'm assuming around 1853 is when it happened. Because they never said.
1853 and the 1860s.
Yeah. So by the 1860s, with the need for extensive repairs, Congress decided to provide funds for a new lighthouse because they're just scrapping this one. The Lighthouse Board prepared plans and specifications, and construction on the new lighthouse began on October of 1868. So really, nothing has worked from 1794 until we'll get there. Since the lighthouse was built,
this is still not working.
I don't think so. Since the lighthouse was built before the present day pile driver was perfected, an interesting problem immediately arose. The groundwater levels of the Outer Banks, or on the Outer Banks, are quite high. So, when they began digging out the pit for the lighthouse foundation, it filled with water about 4 feet down. Working with the natural conditions, the foreman, Dexter Stetson, used a floating foundation for the Cape Hatteras Lighthouse. This meant that layered 6 foot by 12 foot yellow pine timbers were laid crossways in the foundation pit below the water table. Truly, I don't know how that works at all.
He just put a whole bunch of wood down and said, this should
granite,
work.
Granite plinths, which is rock layers, were placed on top of the timbers. So once again, we have a not great lighthouse, is
so
what I'm assuming.
What we
because
said was, you know what we're going to do? We're going to put a whole bunch of wood
and then some rocks.
A material that's just like notoriously good at, you know, withstanding
good
water.
Good at staying in water
sure,
all
right?
the time. Yeah, okay. So the new lighthouse was lit on December 16th, 1870. So I think this might be the first time they have, like, a great working lighthouse.
1870?
1870. And the 1803 lighthouse was demolished in February of 1871, which that took a while to. Oh no, just a couple months. Never mind. So, the Cape Hatteras lighthouse received the famous black and white stripe Daymare pattern in 1873. There's a lot of ship lingo and lighthouse lingo.
Do you know what Mariner the lingo. Might looks like?
No.
That's black and white.
There's a lot Daymare. Of lingo that I don't know, and I'm assuming other people might know it, so I left it in and didn't Google it because it's not really that important to the conversation. So the lighthouse board assigned each lighthouse a distinctive paint pattern, Daymare, and light sequence, Nightmark, to allow mariners to recognize it from all others during the day and night as they sailed along the coast. So there's some history knowledge for you. So the lighthouse is a conical brick structure rising from an octagon-shaped brick and granite base, and wood and water because it's floating. And topped with an iron and glass lantern. It is the tallest brick lighthouse in the U.S. and measures 198.49 feet from the bottom of the foundation to the top of the pinnacle of the tower. There are 269 steps from the ground to the lens room of the lighthouse. Due to threatening beach erosion, the Bureau of Lighthouses decommissioned the Cape Hatteras Lighthouse in 1935. On November 9th, 1937, the Cape Hatteras Light Station was transferred to the National Park Service. While the park was not operational at the time, the lighthouse and the keeper's quarters became part of the nation's first national seashore.
Cool.
Didn't know that until last night. On January 23rd, 1950, the Coast Guard returned the beacon to the lighthouse.
I assume there had been no light in the lighthouse.
That's what I'm and assuming. Returning it. 250,000 candle power is the beacon.
Yeah, so they put the beacon back
in. To the lighthouse since the beach had rebuilt over the years in front of the lighthouse.
It's and like, then, oh no, it's needed again.
Yeah.
The land is back.
In 1972, the beacon was increased to 800,000 candle power, right?
Yes.
And then from the 1960s to the 1980s, efforts were made to stabilize the beach in front of the lighthouse, which had started to erode again. So it didn't last. Well, I guess it lasted from the 50s. In March of 1980, a winter storm swept away the remains of the 1803 lighthouse and caused significant dune erosion. Which, oh, like, no, you, I thought dunes. You destroyed that literally back in 1850-something.
They just must not have done a very good job.
So, in 1999, after years of study and debate, the Cape Hatteras Light Station was moved to its present location. The lighthouse was moved 2,900 feet in 23 days, and now lies 1,500 feet from the seashore, its original distance from the sea. The double keeper's quarters, the principal keeper's quarters, and dwelling cisterns, and the oil house were all relocated with the lighthouse.
It's a whole little tiny town there.
Yes. So the National Park Service currently maintains the lighthouse and the keeper's quarters. The U.S. Coast Guard operates and maintains the automated light.
So it's still an active lighthouse?
I'm pretty sure. It didn't... I mean, why else would there be a light?
Why else would they do that?
Exactly. Yeah.
So now time for the spooky ookies.
Time for spooks, which is a little bit different than most stories.
That's exciting.
So here we go. On January 29th, 1921, the Carol A. Deering was making a return trip to Hampton Roads, Virginia, from Barbados when she passed the Cape Lookout lightship. According to the lightship keeper, the crew was milling about, and a crewman, who did not look or act like an officer, reported that the ship had lost its anchors.
Okay.
Which, I didn't know ships could lose their anchors. I thought it was all attached.
Sometimes they just fall off.
I thought it was all attached. So the following day, the ship passed the SS Lake Ellen, Elon?
I don't know.
Southwest of the Diamond Shoals lightship around 5:45 p.m. The deering seemed to be searing a peculiar course. And then at 6:30 a.m. on January 31st, C.P. Brady of the Cape Hatteras Coast Guard Station spotted a 5-masted schooner in the morning light, aground and helpless on the shoals.
Oh, no.
It was reported that the ship's decks were awash, covered in water. Sails were set, lifeboats were missing, and she appeared abandoned. Due to the heavy seas, the surf boats failed to reach the wreck. Surf boats? Is that right?
I assume the boats that are meant to combat the surf, to, you know, hop the waves.
I mean, I know, I'm just wondering if it was a typo or not. I think it's surf boats.
That makes sense.
The Wrecker Rescue finally arrived on the morning of February 4th, and with the cutter manning, I'm assuming another kind of boat, reached the battered ship around 9:30 a.m. Captain James Carlson of the rescue boarded the ship and confirmed its identity as the Carol, right?
Yeah.
A Deering.
But man Carol, not woman Carol.
So after after investigating the ship, it was discovered that all personal belongings, key navigation equipment, certain papers, and the ship's anchors were missing. So whoever that weirdo was, wasn't lying.
The anchor's not present.
There was also food laid out as if it was in preparation for a meal, but no sign of the crew. And I don't know if they mean like they were about to cook a meal or everybody was about to sit down and eat a meal.
I feel like cook.
But either way, it's weird. Anyway. So, but no crew in sight. I don't know if I said that. No sign of the crew, whatever. So the wrecked and battered hull of the Deering was all that was left to signify the vessel's strange passage, because they took away the whole rest of the ship and, you know, hauled it away.
Mm-hmm.
In April, Christopher Columbus Gray, a Buxton, North Carolina resident, reported finding a note in a bottle which told of the capture of the Deering by pirates. Investigation into the note by the federal government...
In 1921.
When does it say? In April of... Yeah. where was I at?
Pirates.
I know, I can't find it, though.
Christopher Columbus Gray.
So, investigation into the note by the federal government proved the letter was a hoax written by Gray himself. So, don't... You know, Christopher Columbus is never a hero. In May, Mrs. Lula Wormel?
Sure.
The wife of the ship's master, Captain Merritt, the former master, and Reverend Dr. Addison Lorimer, which I don't know why this person comes along, visited Washington and convinced Secretary of Commerce Herbert Hoover to commence an investigation. So, Agent Thompson of the FBI visited Dare County in July of 1921, and among the leads he followed were stories of Bolshevik sympathizing pirates. I don't even know what that means.
Like the Bolshevik Revolution, the people who assassinated the whole Romanov royal family? The Russians.
Yeah, I know. I'm just trying to figure out why this would be a part of that at all, this situation. Rum-running gangsters and mutiny. I do, too.
That's my vote.
When he asked local coastal guardmen about the theories, what is happening?
So those were the theories. He asks the local coastal guardmen about
these
theories.
Oh, when he asked the coastal guardmen about the theories that the crew had mutinied, mm-hmm. Is that the plural of that?
Yeah.
And abandoned ship before striking the shoals, they said that this was impossible since the coast was too rough for lifeboat landings. And they said, quote, somebody said, quote, I believe they abandoned her after taking everything of value and then ran her up on the shoals intentionally, said Captain Balance of the Cape Hatteras Station.
Oh, and is that why it's important that the guy did not look like an officer to feed the mutiny theory?
I guess. Or the pirate theory? I don't know. Everybody's just...
One of those two, though.
It's just a strange story. But yeah, so this main thing that he landed on was that they mutinied and just abandoned shit.
No matter what, everyone left Sketchy and took everything that was worth anything.
Well, not even, because they left all their personal belongings and a lot of random stuff.
Pirates and the gangsters.
So, still to this day, there is no clear answer on what happened, and there has never been any trace of the crew, the ship's log, which was missing, the anchors.
Now, those have done been gone, though.
Or navigation equipment that was missing. It wasn't the important navigation equipment that probably would have actually been worth something. It was just like... I'm assuming compasses. I don't know what else they had back then, but that you could just take off a boat, you know?
Mm-hmm. Just the maps.
So none of that was ever found. So since this incident, people have claimed to hear screams coming from the wreck area around sunrise or sunset.
I think that's just birds.
Which I like that, though. I think that's like funny that it's sunrise or sunset. It's not just like random times when it's a scary night.
Sunrise or sunset.
It's one pretty time of the day. But yeah, so that's like the weird, mystery, spooky thing.
Surrounding this area near the
Surrounding
lighthouse.
This, yeah. And whenever I first started reading about it, at first I thought that they were trying to say that this man who said the anchors were missing was a ghost.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that theory better because maybe he wasn't there. And maybe he was just like trying to warn the other ship that something bad was about to happen. But the crew didn't know it, or they were brainwashed, or it was all a ghost crew at that point anyway. Anyway, that's why I wanted to read it, because that was kind of what I thought was happening. And then I read it, and I was like, kind of lame, but it's kind of fun. Because I love weird boat mysteries. Because where'd they go?
Where did they go?
Where'd they go?
They're dead.
Where are the anchors?
All I know now for sure is they are dead.
Where are the anchors? Anyway, so now on to the short part of little ghost stories that I have. So, guests visiting have reported a spirit, who they have named Bob, because no one's original. He will appear in a yellow raincoat and can be seen wandering inside the lighthouse and around the lighthouse grounds.
He really sounds more like a Clarence based on that, but okay.
Levi. Don't know why, that just came to my head. big storms happen a lot in this area, because they happen everywhere, and especially near the ocean. And they get hurricanes, I believe. People have noticed that right before a big storm is going to hit, a shadowy gray figure of a man has often been seen roaming the beaches of Cape Hatteras. He appears with the first winds of the storms.
He's scaring everybody away.
He's like a big warning that like it's about to really happen. Because the first winds of the storms is like right before your hurricane's about to hit. If anybody approaches him, he fades away into the salt air.
Why are these people on the beaches during these first winds of hurricanes?
Because I don't... You know what I said about North Carolina people? Remember? Okay. So, while visiting the lighthouse, guests have reported seeing a large black and white cat roaming the grounds and inside of the lighthouse. The cat will walk close to people and even rub up against their legs, but when someone tries to pick it up, the cat will vanish. This cat is believed to have been the cat of one of the old lightkeepers and has been seen for decades.
That's cute.
And that's the end of my lighthouse story.
I like how your story was, this lighthouse was chaotic, the ship story is chaotic, here's a cat.
Yes. And a man in a yellow coat, and a storm man. A weatherman.
And the weatherman.
I just thought it was kind of fun.
I like it.
I like mysteries.
Yeah.
But I wanted to find something paranormal. But then they said a ghost cat. And I was like, I don't even care if this is super short. I am doing ghost cat. I think it's cute. And it's a good ending to your crap story.
It's true. It's a real crap story.
Not that you did anything wrong. Just that it was terrible. Anyway... try not to kill anyone and don't mess with Ouija boards. Bye.